My name is Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Dustina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Allison will read the preamble.
I'm Allison. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. David will read the steps.
Thanks. Hi, I'm David. I'm an alcoholic. Step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Number 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Jim H. will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic. These are the traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for a group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never to endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never to be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
4 of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker tonight is Maurice.
Hi, I'm Maurice. I'm an alcoholic. Wow, this is the best seat I've ever had. I really like this. I want to thank my sponsor, Derek. I want to thank Chris for asking me to speak. My grand sponsor, Stacy. And I also want to thank my dad for coming to see me tonight. And this totally just turned into an episode of Full House just now. And I didn't mean for that to happen, but... No, that was it's big for me to have my dad here because for a lot of my life, you know, I was ashamed. You know, I didn't feel good about who I was, and I didn't feel proud to be his son. I didn't feel like I was worthy, really, to be in my family, and I don't feel that way today. And that's really due to, you know, all of you all who I'm looking at. I mean, there was nothing in my past, in my story that said, excuse me. That said, alcoholic, nothing at all. Like, it came from as apple pie as apple pie can be, family. And yet somehow I was always discontent as a kid. You know, I wasn't happy about who I was. You know, I was self-conscious because I was short. I was very short as a kid. You know, I was self-conscious about, you know, these huge Coke bottle glasses that I had, which were always filthy. And I was self-conscious about my braces and, you know, my headgear and everything like that. And, you know, kids used to call me Steve Urkel when I was growing up. And I really identified with that, actually. And I remember at some point Steve Urkel got a girlfriend and I felt betrayed, you know. And that's just who I was, you know. I was that kid and I didn't like it. And so, you know, it took a while for me to actually find alcohol. It actually happened when I was in high school. And like a lot of us, I was an isolator, you know, and I was a person that always saw differences. So I was looking for any way that I could separate myself from everyone else because nobody could possibly understand me, you know. So, you know, when nobody can understand you, you can pretty much rationalize any behavior you want to rationalize. So, I remember my first drunk was when I was in high school, and I don't remember much of it. I actually had to piece it together. I blacked out, and I woke up the next day in my friend's guest bed and just completely covered in vomit. And he gave me a ride to the subway because I was going to go home. And I remember asking him what had happened the previous night. I was so embarrassed about, you know, my condition. And he was like, well, you know, it was kind of strange. We lost you for a while. And then, you know, we went into this room and you were hanging out with the football team. And, you know, there were these cheerleaders around and they were kissing you on the cheek. And I was so proud. Like, I was so proud. And, you know, that's really what my drinking was about. You know, it didn't matter what the consequences were for me. It didn't matter how much I inconvenienced someone else. The only thing that mattered was, for, you know, however long, for a half an hour, for an hour, for 2 hours, I felt like I was accepted, and I felt like I was cool. I didn't even remember it. It was just the fact that I knew that it happened. And that's what my drinking became, you know. My drinking became almost like my alter ego, in a way, you know. Just anything that I was unhappy about in my life, I didn't bother to fix it because I had this nightlife. I had this other person that could take care of everything. You know, it was almost like jobs. I could never show up for a job. I could never show up for a relationship. But whenever I felt inconvenienced, it was almost like, you know, how dare you? Like, you know, do you know who I am at nighttime? You know? It's like, I'm a bad boy 12 beers in, you know? You know? And that's what it was. I didn't bother to deal with what was actually going on in my life. The only thing that mattered to me was that I had this other thing that I could do where I really did feel a part of, and where I really did feel like I was in, and I really did feel cool, and I really felt like I was the man. And my story really started to turn around. You know, my bottom was stretched out over a very long period of time. It wasn't one isolated event. What happened was I just found myself watching a movie that was my life, and I had absolutely no way of interjecting myself or affecting what was going on. Every day was the exact same. I had no idea how to break the cycles that I was in. I had you know, hopes and dreams that I had told myself I was one day going to achieve and one day going to move towards, but not today. And today was just all about being happy, which for me was drinking. And I worked with a guy who was in this program, and he offered me a copy of the Big Book. And I remember reading it. I remember opening up and reading. I probably read about 2 pages, and my immediate reaction was anger, because I was like, how dare he plant these things about me in this book, you know? And then I remembered that I had never told anybody the things that I was reading in the Big Book about myself. I had never told anyone, you know? I was too ashamed, or I didn't know how to express these things to other people. And there it was, right there in print. These guys back in the 1930s in middle America knew exactly how I felt. And none of my friends did, and none of my family did, but they did. And so I immediately identified with this program, and I immediately identified myself as an alcoholic. Now, I would love to say I came running in, and I started, you know, attending meetings. Didn't happen that way. It was another 3 years before I actually came into this program, but that was a process that I needed to go through, because during the course of that 3 years, I tried every single way I possibly could to make it work on my own. You know, I tried drinking at night, I tried drinking during the day, I tried drinking only with people, I tried drinking only alone, I tried drinking in public, only in private. Like, I tried everything I possibly could, and I couldn't make it work. So at the end of that process, I knew exactly where to come, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've joined this group, which is my home group, when I had about 30 days, and I remember walking through that door, and I was completely overwhelmed with the sheer volume of people, and I had no idea alcoholics could look so good, and I had no idea alcoholics could be so could have that shine on their face, you know, that I see here from this podium from so many of you. And my initial reaction was to leave, because I didn't feel inside as good as you all looked. And that immediately causes disdain. And that was something that I had had a trait of mine for a long time. But something inside me, I don't know if it was grace, if it was the gift of desperation, but something inside me caused me to stay. It was my higher power really interjecting himself in my situation. I got a sponsor who has done a fantastic job, and it's just so amazing to call myself a member of this group, not just Atlantic Group, but also Alcoholics Anonymous, because in any other place, there's so many reasons for me to say why I can't identify with this person. This person can't possibly understand me. This person can't possibly be my friend. But I pick up the phone on a daily basis at my sponsor's suggestion and call other alcoholics, and they say, I know exactly how you feel. That never happened before. That never, ever happened before. And it's a gift that I will always cherish. Those mandatory calls that my sponsor suggested to me in the beginning have become my absolute best friends in the world, and I'm so grateful for that. I have a relationship with my higher power today that I never had before. You know, like, I wake up and I don't have to be perfect. You know, I don't have to fix everything myself. I don't have to control the way that other people behave. I just have to do the best that I can do. And I can't tell you how valuable a gift that is. I was absolutely blessed with 2 new guys that I'm working with, and right now, and I'm grateful for them as well. And just the ability to give back, the ability to say that, you know what, that situation that I went through, you don't have to go through it. You know, I have a use for that now. I don't have to have regret. I have a place to put those things now. And that is a gift that you all have given me. So if you are new, I can say I did not feel good about being here when I first came. But, you know, do not quit before the miracle happens. Do not quit before the miracle happens. There is so much love in this room. There are so many reasons why I wanted to leave, and I stayed, and there's no place I'd rather be. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Mary M.
Hi, everybody. My name is Mary. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Atlanta Group. My sponsor is Marie. And I had my last drink on October 25th, 1987. And first, I'd like to start out by thanking Marie for helping me so much this past year. Really appreciate it. I'm originally from Oregon, from a small town in Oregon. And I remember, you know, as young as 10 years old, I wondered what it was like to be drunk. And, you know, none of my sisters ever thought about that. And I tasted my dad's beer when I could. And when I was 16, I got drunk for the first time at my girlfriend's. We went through her parents' cupboard and had one drink of every kind of liquor that was in there. And I don't remember if I got sick or had a hangover. All I remember is that I felt really great and that I wanted to keep doing that. So I did. I started doing that every weekend the rest of high school. And I went from being on honor roll and a cheerleader to barely graduating. I kicked off the squad and kicked out of clubs and, you know, barely graduating. And when I got out of high school, it was, you know, the 60s, and like someone said to me once, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. One thing that was, I always wanted to travel, I always wanted to go to Europe, and I thought I'd go to Europe, then I'd come back to Oregon and marry my high school sweetheart and do like everybody else did. And when I got to Europe, I realized that I wanted to see more, and especially when I went to Morocco. It was like, wow. So I moved to New Zealand, and I lived there for a year. I was a nanny. And then I went on to Australia and spent 2 years there working my way around, getting different jobs. I spent a year in Asia backpacking around. And I drank and took whatever was popular, available, whatever country I was in. In the early 80s, I realized I couldn't keep getting jobs and quitting all the time because I was getting older. And so I managed to get a job with the government. And believe me, I don't know how I did it, but I wouldn't get it now, I'm sure. So the first place they sent me was South America. And I was in Uruguay for a year, and then I was in Bolivia for a couple years. And all I'll say about Bolivia is I'm glad, you know, I'm lucky I'm alive. I went from there, I was posted to South Africa, and that was when I started drinking alone at home at night. And I started getting, you know, depressed. Then I got sent to Liberia, and I was like the new girl in town, and it was like party every night, and it was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. One night, I was walking home from a disco late, and I was attacked by 5 guys with knives, and they punched me in the face. I lost my 2 front teeth. My face was all bruised, and the guy I was with was stabbed. And I went to work the next day, acting like, you know, no big deal. And I started having trouble, at the same time, I was also having trouble sleeping. And so I went to the doctor at the embassy, and I said, you know, I'm having trouble sleeping, and he gave me Halcyon. And I said, can I drink with this? And he goes, oh, yeah, you can have a beer or two. Well, of course, I didn't have a beer or two. And it started getting really crazy. I'd wake up in the middle of the night and wouldn't remember if I took something, if I drank something. I just got all confused. And I was working for the ambassador. So it's amazing. One day I went home for lunch. I lived across the street. And I started feeling like I was going crazy, like I was losing my mind. And it was an anxiety attack, a really big anxiety attack. I was so paranoid, I couldn't cross the street by myself. I had to have somebody help me, and they took me to the embassy doctor, and to make a long story short, I was medically evacuated and sent back to Washington, and they sent me to rehab in Pennsylvania. And then they told me I had to be sober for a year before I could go overseas again. And that's what kept me going to meetings. I went to meetings because I didn't know what else to do. You know, I just still had so much anxiety. I still wasn't sleeping. And I went because I didn't want to lose my job. And whenever they mentioned God at these meetings, I would just cringe. And for a long time, AA was my higher power. The group was my higher power. And then I started realizing that if I wasn't going to try this spiritual thing, I was going to keep feeling, you know, the way I was. I had a choice there. So I started, you know, really taking the program, you know, seriously. And 2.5 years later, they let me go to Israel. And one thing that helped me, you know, with the higher power thing was I started thinking about all the times, all the things that had happened to me in all these countries, and I was still alive. I mean, a lot of stuff happened. And, you know, I was just thinking, you know, either somebody or something was watching over me, or, you know, I was just lucky. So I went to Tel Aviv. It was the first time I was traveling sober. And I married an Israeli, and we were married for like 10 years. We went together to my next two assignments, which were India and Mexico. I went to meetings in both those places. Then we got sent to Georgia, the former Soviet Union, Georgia. And there weren't any meetings there. And this is where I want to talk about fellowship, because it was amazing. I listed my name in the International Directory as a loner, and every time a traveler came through town, they would come to my house, and we'd have a meeting. And people started sending me letters from all over the world. I mean, I got them from everywhere, and I couldn't even answer them all, you know? And I was, there were meetings on the internet that I was doing. People were sending me tapes, books. I mean, it was just incredible. And I felt so, my husband, while we were there, decided he wanted a divorce. And at that time, I was so glad that I stayed close to the program, because I was truly, you know, devastated. So I went back to Washington, and I got a job in the White House. And now I'm here at the UN. Now, you know, who would think, you know, that I would end up having those jobs? And it's all, you know, because of AA. I'm really grateful for the Atlanta group. When I first came to New York 4 years ago, I wasn't going to meetings that often, and my boyfriend was my higher power. He also was an addict, and you know, when he broke up with me, of course, I was devastated. And so I started going to meetings again. And somebody said, brought me here to the Atlanta group. And it was really what I needed. I needed to go through the big book again. I needed to start all over with the steps. And it has helped me so much over the past year. And now I have a new assignment. And in July, I'll be going to Beirut. And for 2 years, and I'm sure that there's going to be fellowship there too. I was in one country once where it wasn't their normal meeting night, and they called all their members, and they had a meeting just for me, you know. It was just really amazing. And I just want to say that I love Alcoholics Anonymous, that it saved my life. And if you're new, really stick around. It really, really does get better. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Brian.
Hi, everybody. My name is Brian, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an incredible group, an extraordinary group of people. My last drink was January 16th, 1990. My sponsor is Peggy Byrne. I'm one of Peggy's kids. I was thinking as I was sitting in the chair, before you get up to speak here, it felt like, I don't know if any of you remember these, but going in the roller coaster, and you chugged your way to the top, and you said, this is either going to scare the hell out of me, or it's going to be fine. And I kept thinking, it's chugging and it's chugging. Well, we're here at the top. Somebody in January, guys I work with down on Wall Street, said to me, you haven't had a drink in 17 years? I mean, seriously. I mean, you haven't had a cold beer? You haven't had a little scotch, some wine, a martini? You know, I said, no, I know I haven't. And I... You know, there was just the way my alcoholic mind works. I went home and I said, you know, a cold beer, wow. Baseball season is coming. I never went to a baseball game without a beer. So, and I immediately was able, by the grace of God, to snap back to reality and realize the kind of damage alcohol had done to me. But there's always a part that every once in a while I'll only remember the good times. So I've got to be very, very careful and, you know, keep my eye on the ball and stay focused. My story has been really one specifically about alcoholism. I first came to the rooms in 1968. I was four. No. I came in 68, and I wrestled with it for the next 22 years, having 7 years, 5 years, 4 years. And during that period of time, I always thought, as long as I didn't drink, my life would be fine. I can only tell you that is the furthest thing from the truth for me. It was simply a symptom of what was going on with me. I am the classic case in the big book. I was the actor on the stage. I was a fraud. I was a liar. I was a manipulator. I had a little bit of charm, so I was able to BS my way through life. And even when I lost jobs, I got better jobs. I will tell you a little bit about my background, but I wanted to relay a story, episode that happened to me about 6 months ago. I was on the subway, and I got on and had on my best suit and best tie, and the subway was crowded, and very attractive woman was sitting down and looking up at me, and I gave her the best, sexiest Clendenin smile I could give her. And she smiled back at me, and I said, you know, the kid still got it. He still got it. And she smiled back at me and then said, would you like my seat? So there was a little commotion when I pushed her back in the seat. Now, but humility is out there in all forms. So My background is from a drinking background. My father was an alcoholic. It killed him. I'm not sure about my mother because she died when I was at an early age. My brothers, I have two older brothers, and they both drank. There's 7 years separation, so I'm 14 years younger than my oldest brother. And so I was sort of like an only child, and my father was in the throes of active alcoholism. He also, when I look back on it, was filled with, even when he wasn't drinking, the arrogance, the dishonesty, the fraud that goes along, certainly in my case, with alcoholism. So I was around that all the time, and I had this enormous fear about myself. My father remarried to a woman who didn't really understand kids or certainly understand me, so I was scared to death. Even in those days, when I wasn't playing basketball, I would isolate. I just, you know, like many people you hear, didn't feel like you fit in, wasn't good enough, wasn't good enough basketball player. Although, you know, I sat on the bench for a lot of teams. So I was scared to death, afraid. And my father had the great ability to emotionally abandon me, except at Christmas. And I found myself doing exactly the same thing. I was emotionally unavailable for my children, except at Christmas. Somehow that was going to make the big difference. So after my father, after I went off to college, I really found what I was looking for. And what I found was an enormous relief for all the things that were going on between my ears, and that was alcohol. It was wonderful. I mean, it made me a much better dancer. The stories blew into enormous epics. When I came back into these rooms several times, I didn't know fact from fiction. I had lied about so many things. I didn't know what was the truth anymore. And my drinking really picked up when, after college, and I went off to the service in Korea. I mean, I was in between wars. I was in between the Korean War and the Vietnam War, which was fortunate for our country because I wasn't much of a soldier, although I claimed that I was defending the world against the communists, but nobody really bought that. But I was sort of in between, and what we did in Korea is we drank. We played cards. So my drinking really stepped up to a, you know, I really raised the bar on my drinking. When I came home and got a job, and my first job I got, out drinking with the guys, I loved to have fun. I never felt good about very many things. So what helped that was me being able to have alcohol in my system. Things were always better, but I could never, ever go home. You know, guys would say, okay, it's 10 o'clock. I have to go home now. I have to work in the morning. For me, the gun was fired, and it was time to really party. And that's what I like to do. I prided myself on the fact that I could stay out longer. And there were many occasions, I always tell the story about one time waking up, coming out of a blackout, and people looking at me as I was laying in the bed, just staring at me, and I just raised my hands up and I said, all I want to know is, do I need a lawyer? That's how I live my life. I wasn't sure what went on that night. So people would always say, hey, you know, you're really a good guy, Brian, but your drinking is concerns us. And I, during those periods of time, let's see, I drove cars off of cliffs with people in them. By the grace of God, nobody was killed. Drove cars into lakes because I had a lot of things to do. You know, I had a lot of stories to tell. I had radios to work. I had shtick I wanted to do because I wanted to be Mr. Entertainer. So that's what I did, not paying attention to anything around me, the surroundings. And when I drank, everything seemed like a good idea. Whatever you wanted to do, okay. I was a great follower. I had not one original idea in my whole head. Okay, I'll go. Oh, yeah. It seems like a good idea to me. We're going to have fun. I'm in. Count me in. So I have this theory that certainly in the Clendenin family, the male of the species doesn't have a conscious thought till he's 35. So my son, who's just turned 35, the light went on. So I'm, thank God for that. And that's, you know, and I kept getting into trouble. I couldn't get the work. People liked me. I did a pretty good job. I'd have horrendous hangovers. But they cleared up at 4:45. And then I'd go, that's it, one drink. I'm only going down for one drink. And then at 2 in the morning, I was out wandering the streets of Manhattan. So that's how my drinking went. I knew I lost a job, almost lost another job, and I decided what I needed to do was to get my feet on the ground and get married. Because in the book, you get married, you have children, you have a picket fence, you got a dog, you got a mortgage, and you make a lot of money and you live happily ever after. I was 28 years of age. My other brothers had been married before then, so I figured it was time for me. So this poor woman said yes, and it was just a total disaster. We had two wonderful children, and but I was just totally unavailable, totally irresponsible. I was a lousy, lousy husband and an even worse father. Because all I thought I had to do was make the money. Let me make the money. Don't bug me. Leave me alone. You mean you want to talk to me? No, I got to watch the ball game. You know, I'll be out with the guys. The old meeting with the guys routine. I didn't want to do it, I used to tell her, but it was for business. So that's what I did. And finally, for her sake, I decided that it was not working. And by this time, I was in Chicago. And I had been moving right up the line. People kept offering me jobs because somehow I had them all snowed. And finally, I got another job out in San Francisco. And she went back to New York with the two kids. Then I went into and lost that job within 60 days. I lost the job in San Francisco. And I was, had a pretty important job, and I was fired. So I then went, I remember, I had like $700 to my name, and I thought I had two options. I could either go back to AA, or I could take the $700 and go to Vegas and make $1 million. Because if I had enough money, people would leave me alone. You know, stop, you know, asking me to be responsible. So, by the grace of God, I decided to go to an AA meeting and I met some guys. And this was 1975. And for the next 7.5 years, I was abstinent. I went to a lot of meetings. I used to go to San Quentin every week. Had looked into Charlie Manson's cell, did a lot of what we used to call the old days two-steppers. I was a one-step and 12-step. All those other steps were for you guys who really had problems. Me, I didn't need all that. I just stopped drinking, and I can carry the word. And because the truth was, in my gut, I was different. I was different. These steps, these traditions, your book, didn't really apply to me because I was different. During that period of time, I got a divorce, and because I was not sober, I remarried. I was abstinent and was not capable of making a responsible, mature decision about my life. Could not do it. I just said, well, it seemed like a good idea. Maybe this will help. I wasn't drinking. My life was better. I was starting to make a lot of money. But in my gut, I knew things were not good. Within a year of that marriage, I was drinking again. Back to the program. So over those nearly 40 years, I probably had drank for 3 to 4 years. But the alcoholism inside me is so strong. Had I only opened your book and done the work in the steps, my life could have been dramatically different. But I chose not to. Because basically, I'm a lazy person. I want to come in here, and you're going to give me something, and fine, that's it. And when I came back in 1990, people get off at certain levels when they come into these rooms. Some people get off at the fifth floor, the second floor, the ground floor. I got off in the sub-basement. I got off where I had not a nickel left, because if I had any money, I'd still have been out there and probably have died. But I had no money left. They were repossessing my car. My second wife had thrown me out. This is in 1990. So I had nothing left. So it's pure and simple desperation. And I was blessed with that. I feel that's a solid blessing in my life. And I heard a couple of things that were important to me. I heard a guy say at the workshop, if you're in these rooms for more than 2 years and you're not happy, you're doing something wrong. Ooh, I had remember getting my fifth year chip saying, this is all there is to this? It's just not good. I mean, I'm not drinking and I'm miserable. And the other thing I heard was, attaining emotional sobriety. Emotional sobriety. I had had physical, call it what you will, sobriety, abstinence. I had had that. But nothing emotional about anything in my life. And I will just, for the newcomers, and there are so many of you, and it's great to hear all the names and all the people who raised their hand, and you're not sure where you are in your life. When I came back, I owed $900,000 to the IRS. I had no job. I was almost 50 years of age. I was too old. Both wives, children, nobody talking to me. My car was repossessed down on the shore, Jersey Shore. And when I came back to New York, my sponsor kept saying to me, you know, I kept worrying about the past and about the future. I could never get my feet in today. And he would always say to me, Brian, what are you doing today to make your life a little bit better? Go to a meeting. You call me. This is the step we're working on. I don't want to do that. You know how much harm I've caused, and I want to feel sorry for myself. And, in the future, that's where I wanted to be. Just today, he kept saying, what are you going to do today? So anyway, I got an interview for a job, and I like to tell this story for those of you who are wondering and concerned about your future. And I went back to interview, and my name was sort of well known for in certain circles, and I figured I'd never land a job back in Wall Street. And I went to this firm, and I met with the three partners, and they interviewed me, and it went well. And they knew my brother, who was kind of a big shot, so they knew that name, so they thought the name would help them. So, but I went back, and I said, look, I'm not going to get the job. They're going to find out about me that I'm a drunk and so forth and so on. And my sponsor kept saying to me, just trust. God will take care of you. Yeah, that's very easy for you guys who've been sober for a while, but for, you know, I've been sober 22 minutes. I'm not sure about this trusting thing. They said, trust. It'll be okay. God will take care of you. Use that resource. Okay. And I always tell everybody I can speak, I had to pray every 15 minutes. The insanity was so raging inside me. The resentments, the fears. God, help me. Help me through the next half hour. And I didn't hear from anybody. It went on and on. And finally, about a week after the interview, I was going into the workshop, and I was going down the steps, for those of you who know that location, and up walked one of the three partners, who had been a member for 22 years. So he looked at me and said, hey, how you doing? I said, great. He said, oh, by the way, you're hired. So those are the kinds of things that happened to me and have been continuously happening to me since I've been in these rooms. It has not always been easy because I am, unfortunately, I have an ego. And I let that get in the way of good, solid following what goes on in these rooms. Because sometimes I think I know better. Sometimes I'm smarter. I fall victim to that. And I left this group for a couple of years. But the only thing I can remember, and the analogy that I use, is that when I left the United States and went to Korea, I came back, and when I got off that ship back in the United States, I kissed the ground because I then appreciated what this country was all about. And when I came back here, this is an extraordinary group with extraordinary people. I mean, I tell people, I mean, the bonding among the women. I come into here at 6:15, and there are people all over the place working on the book, talking about steps, and the poor newcomer is sitting there being, it's outstanding. You know, I got involved. I then met Van and Peggy, and one of the proudest things that I have in my life is the fact that while working with Van, we went around and we got together. We wanted to do some things with this big book meeting because Van was no short of opinions, and like myself, we decided maybe we could make it a little bit better. So we would meet, and as it turned out, my apartment, Myra and Peggy and Jeff and other guys in the rooms. And we sat there and we developed this big book meeting. You know, and I went back to it this last semester. It's unbelievable. You guys have taken it to a new level. But I have some pride in that, some sort of contribution that I've made. I think, all in all, what the program has given me is the ability to really enjoy my sobriety. That's what it's about for me. You know, I was listening to all that. Randy and Rashesh talking about all these things they're doing. I mean, if I was a newcomer, had 2 days, you people are having way too much fun. I mean, if I had 2 days, I'm miserable. For those of you who have little time and they bugged you, don't worry. They'll keep bugging you, and you'll go to these things, as I did. It's a terrific group of people with a terrific group of people who know how to take care of each other. That's what's key for me. Extraordinary people. And I think one of the things I'd just like to say about my sponsor is what she has shown me and given to me is really the key to this program, and that is spirituality. For those of you who wrestle with this issue, put down the debating card and try it. Be willing. Be willing. When I talk to Peggy, there is always a spiritual component to everything she gives me. And, you know, I go home and I say, you know, that's absolutely right. And then when you go through the big book study, you see, hey, that's what Wilson discovered too. It's about this relationship with a higher power. And he talks about it, the dependency on a higher power. Not a dependency on sponsors. A dependency, and in some parts of the book, they say we get too dependent on sponsors. God is really the deal for me. Because by myself, when I'm alone, and I do my praying, a lot of my praying in the shower in the morning, because that's where I used to sober up, I have my conversations. The formalized prayers in the book are fine. I just have a conversation. Well, what do I do today? Who should I call today? Who can I be of service today? Who can I help? And I always, always, always get direction. Make a call to your daughter. You haven't talked to her. My partner in life, she is simply the best person I have ever met. She is and I work really, really well together. We have a lot of fun. I'm a fun junkie. I gotta have fun. I gotta laugh. I gotta enjoy my life. And she's there when things get stressful. I can be helpful to her. She is extraordinarily helpful to me. And we're getting down to the end here. And I just, one thing I'd like to leave you with. I was privileged to see, I don't know if any of you saw it, Bill W. and Dr. Bob, the off-Broadway show. If it's still running, I don't even know if it still is, but it's worth seeing. Like when Clancy said he went in hope, thinking he would hate it, so did I. I said, I'm, you know, very protective of our program, and I don't want these guys taking advantage of it. It was very, very well done. And there were some things I didn't know. But I think the line I remember the most, and I leave this with all of you, is we all have received this gift of sobriety. We all have received gifts of enjoying our lives, gifts of some cash and prizes, perhaps, because sobriety has allowed us to do that. But the last words in this show, with the character playing Bill W., talks about, as he left Dr. Bob, who was on his deathbed, I say this to all of you, now that you've received these gifts, Bob looked at Bill W. and said, "Don't you screw it up." Thank you all very much.